It's always a pleasure for me to come back to the Walla Walla Valley and see familiar faces. This week I was at Milton State Line School sharing during the week of worship, and my wife and my daughter were not with me until Thursday, which meant I was free to do what I wanted. So I did. And I spent a lot of time visiting familiar places around the Walla Walla Valley from which I have fond memories. And today it's good to be here because I have a lot of fond memories from here. Did you know that in my church in Coeur d'Alene, I use this church as an illustration frequently? Yeah, when it's an illustration of what not to do, or it's a negatively focused illustration, it's usually about something I did here. And when it's a positive one, it's usually about something you did here. So thank you for being that positive influence in my life. It's good to be here. There's a Greek myth about a goddess who came to earth completely unseen. Nobody could see this goddess. But as she moved around the earth, her presence left blessings everywhere that she went. Trees that had been burnt by forest fires began to sprout new leaves, and violets began to come up in her footsteps in the path that she walked. When she would walk past a pool of stagnant water, it would become fresh and clean again. Hills and valleys would begin to blossom with new life wherever she walked. Sounds like a pretty beautiful goddess to have in one's life, isn't it? There's another Greek story about another princess who was sent to a king as a gift. She was beautiful like Aphrodite, and she had breath that was sweet smelling. But on her breath, she carried the contagion of death and decay. And no matter how beautiful she was, and no matter how sweet her breath smelled, poison followed her wherever she went. She had fed on that poison since she was a small child, and she was so incredibly poisoned that poison permeated every step she took. Her breath would kill a swarm of insects that flew too close. Flowers withered as she walked by them, and birds would fall dead out of the sky if they caught a whiff of that sweet-smelling breath. In Matthew's gospel, we find that the people of Galilee were all twitterpated about this new teacher that they had seen going from city to city, this man named Jesus. And the reason why they were so excited about what they were hearing was because what they were hearing was preaching about the kingdom unlike anything they had ever heard before. And along with that preaching came practical things that were blessings in their lives. For example, everywhere he went, the Bible tells us, everyone was healed of whatever disease they had. This was good news that was coming from this teacher, something that nobody else had done for them. As the news spread about Jesus, it spread as far as Asia Minor and all these surrounding areas, and people came from far and wide to listen to what this man had to say. People would crowd around Jesus because they were desperate for something good. They were desperate for something new. They were desperate for something that came from God. Ellen White describes the influence that Jesus had on people in Desire of Ages. She says, Jesus was the fountain of healing mercy for the world. And through all those secluded years at Nazareth, his life flowed out in currents of sympathy and tenderness. The aged, the sorrowing, and the sin-burdened, the children at play in their innocent joy, the little creatures of the groves, the patient beasts of burden, all were happier for his presence. Sounds beautiful, doesn't it? I want you to turn with me in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. And in Matthew chapter 5, we find that Jesus has already been walking with his disciples from town to town, and he has been blessing people along the way. But when we come to Matthew chapter 5, Jesus stops all the things that he had been doing from town to town, and he decides to spend some time focusing his attention on his disciples. And what he says was not meant for everyone else. It was meant for them. And today, as professed Christ followers, as disciples of Jesus, I believe that the words that he speaks here in Matthew chapter 5 belong to us as well. And so in Matthew chapter 5, we find Jesus' famous dissertation called the Sermon on the Mount. And I want to focus on Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. You heard them already read, but let's read them again. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. In these verses, Jesus describes what the function or the purpose of a professed Christ follower is. And the fact that you're here today leads me to believe that at some level, you're probably a professed Christ follower. And so, I look at these verses for each of us as a description of the function or purpose that we have. And in one word, very short, that function or purpose that Jesus describes is influence. The function or the purpose of a Christ follower is influence. You see, every person, each one of us here today, affects others around us. We affect others around us either for better or for worse. And you might think that as a Christian, we automatically affect people for better. We automatically affect people for good. And I got bad news for you if that's what you're thinking, because that just ain't true. We affect people for better or for worse. But no matter if you affect people for better or for worse, Jesus is very, very clear. You are the salt of the world. You are the light of the world. You have influence in the world around you. Salt is an interesting thing that Jesus uses to describe this, because it has always played a crucial role in the history of mankind. In fact, for a short period of Greek history, the Greeks referred to salt with the Greek word theon, which is divine. They would call salt by the word for divine. That's how important of a role it played in their economy. The Romans considered salt to be the most important commodity known to man, second only to the sun. This is how the Romans viewed salt. It was critical for their lives. And in fact, for some time, Roman soldiers, for example, would be paid in salt. That's where we get the term, that man's not worth his salt. You've heard that one. Or maybe that man is worth his salt. That's a nicer way to put it, right? Salt played a significant role in people's lives. But there were other ways that the Bible tells us that salt was used. One example is in the book of 2 Kings, where Elijah comes upon a spring of water that is bitter and it is contaminated and it isn't good for drinking. And the Bible tells us that he did something that, at least in my mind, seems a little bit odd, but I think it has spiritual significance that we're not going to get into today. But he takes a bowl of salt and dumps it into the spring of water, and it comes out sweet tasting and good for humans to drink. And so it has some purifying agent to it. Also in Leviticus chapter 2, we find that God commanded people to season their grain offerings with salt before presenting them to the Lord. And all of this is to say that salt has benefited mankind in many different ways throughout the centuries, from spiritual to physical to simply making your food taste good. Salt is good stuff. And Jesus tells us, you are the salt of the world. As Christ followers, we have an opportunity to bring life to people. And there are some people who have this idea that as Christians, we are called to disassociate ourselves from this world. We're told to draw back by some people and to be reclusive because we don't want to become contaminated by what the world has to offer. But I would suggest that Jesus' words here actually describe something very different that we're called to do. We're in fact called to enter into the world in full force, permeating the world with the joy of Jesus everywhere we go, because we are called to be agents of redemption, people who share the message of Jesus and the saving grace that he has for all. Jesus also says, "You are the light of the world." So, what is it that light does? Light has a very particular purpose, and that is to help us see the things around us. And the thing that's so interesting when the light lights up the things that we can now see is that sometimes the things that we see are good, and we're happy to see those things. And other times, things are not so good, and you wish you could just turn the light off again because something isn't quite the way you wanted it to look. And Jesus tells us that we are the light of the world. Now, spiritually speaking, we know that there's really only one light of the world that is the true light, right? And we find that in John chapter 8, verse 12. And if you have your Bibles, you can turn. Oh, I think I have it on the screen there. In John chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus again speaks to the people and he says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And so, some people might think that this feels a little bit contradictory to know that Jesus is the only light of the world, yet Jesus says, "You are the light of the world." But Paul really captured it really well in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, because what we find, the statement about us being the light of the light in this world, is that Jesus' disciples are people who reflect the light that's shining in their own lives. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6, Paul says that we are given the... Back up one slide, I think. Yeah, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Christ's followers are called to be reflectors of light. And true light is found in Jesus. And Jesus also tells his disciples how they can know if they're reflecting that light right. In Matthew chapter 5 again, in verse 16, we find Jesus saying this, "In the same way, let your light," this is a reflective light, "shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." Now, I know that there are some people who hear this idea of letting people see your good deeds, they get a little bit cringy about that. Oh, we're not supposed to make this idea that we're so great or anything like this. And the thing is that when Jesus calls us to show our good deeds to people, what God is asking us to do is to live our lives in a manner that causes the people who see the way that we live our lives not to think better of us, but instead to give glory to the one who created us. And so when you feel a little bit weird about letting people see your good deeds, or you think that that might be self-serving or something about you, recognize that our opportunity to live our lives in good ways is something that can bring glory to God. But there's another so-called light that exists. Have you heard the statement that for every good thing God created, Satan created a... For example, God created chickens to lay eggs. And for every good thing that God has created, Satan has created a counterfeit, like tofu, right? Okay, so you see the example there, right? It all makes sense now, right? Okay, we're on the same page. Now, for every good thing that God has created, Satan creates a counterfeit. And with the light that God is, Satan has tried desperately to counterfeit that light that God is. And maybe sometimes on its surface, it looks good, attractive, perhaps even right. But its results are always detrimental. Satan's counterfeit light can never bring life into people. It can only speak in terms of death and decay. What does this counterfeit light look like? It takes on a lot of different shapes and forms. Some of the ones that I see regularly are rejoicing in the pain and misfortune of others. We call it humor, but it's really a counterfeit type of humor. We find it in attitudes of racism and bigotry, but we say that we're protecting American values, or we're just doing what we believe is right. But it's hatred nonetheless, and goes directly against the light of God. Perhaps the way that I most frequently see this counterfeit light played out in my church and in other churches is an unwillingness to cooperate with others in the church because they have different ideas of how to approach the Bible or different ideas of how we practically live out the values that we find in the Bible. And because we disagree, we can't cooperate with one another any longer. These are not the ways of God. No matter how we try to soften it or couch it in ways that favor us, they are a part of counterfeit light that Satan wants us to reflect to the world around us. And the truth is that whether you're reflecting the light of Jesus or Satan's counterfeit light, you are the light of the world. And light cannot be hidden. You know, when we're acting in ways that align with Jesus' light, we don't want that to be hidden, right? We want everybody to see that far and wide and bring praise and glory to our Father in heaven. But consciously or unconsciously, by living your life the way that you choose to live it, your light is on a stand for others to see. And your influence affects people for better or for worse, for good or for bad, for the glory of God or, and this might sound a little bit harsh, for the glory of Satan. I was out to eat with somebody several weeks ago now, somebody who worked at a conference office, not in Upper Columbia Conference, elsewhere. And Cambry and I were sitting there eating with this man who worked at the conference office, and he began to speak in ways that were so degrading to the waitress who was serving us. He began to tell her that she didn't know what she was doing, and this isn't how that dish is supposed to look, and you're doing this wrong. I mean, it was absolutely mortifying. And I thought, well, I can, I guess, sit through this with irritation and frustration until he said the words, and I know what I'm talking about because I come here often because I work at the office across the street. Oh, I thought to myself, the only office across the street is that conference office. I was absolutely mortified because of the light that this person was reflecting. And I don't know if he was doing it consciously or unconsciously, but he probably thought that this person will never put two and two together. This person has no idea that that is the Adventist church. I, however, thought, this person seems rather intelligent to me. They can probably figure it out. I don't want to be anywhere around this. And I couldn't get out of there quickly enough. Back in Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, which is where we initially began, Jesus says some words that give grave implications for professed followers of Christ. He says in verse 13, "You are the salt of the world. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. Now, I'm pretty sure that salt never actually entirely loses its saltiness, but it can become rather bland and tasteless because it can become impure. And one of the things that people in Jesus' day would have been very careful about with the salt that they had in their homes was to make sure it would never become contaminated. They didn't want their salt to become impure. And when Jesus talks about the impurity of this salt, he uses the word in Greek, moros. Moros means insipid or flat. And in other places in the New Testament, when this word is used, it is translated as foolish. In fact, our 21st century word that we might be familiar with that comes from this Greek word is moron. A moron, in its most literal sense, is someone who has ceased to have positive influence for the sake of the gospel. And Jesus' approach to this kind of corrupted salt was to throw it out because it's worthless. Now, I don't want us to think that Jesus is trying to give us some ideas here to create a theology of salvation from. I don't think this has anything to do with the salvation of individuals. However, I would say that one who becomes unsalty or a moron does have grave implications for one's salvation. This, however, is a statement about influence. Because as professed followers of Jesus Christ, we have influence with the people around us in the way that we speak, in the way that we act, in the way that we live our lives from day to day. And when Jesus sees people who are living their lives against the light of heaven, he says that they have become useless for the sake of the gospel. Because our influence leads people away from a positive understanding of Jesus. Christ's followers who cease to bring life to people in their sphere of influence, who cease to be bearers of light, reflecting God to the world, have missed the entire point of Christianity. This week I saw a couple of things on my social media feed that gave me pause. I'm going to share three of them with you very briefly. Two of them that really struck me as very unfortunate, and one that I was very pleasantly surprised by. The first one that I saw was a picture of a note that somebody had left on a table at a restaurant as a tip to the waiter or the waitress. It was a piece of paper about this big, and it was folded up, and on one section of it, there was a printing of a $20 bill. And it was folded up in such a way that when you tucked it under the plate, it looked actually like a $20 bill. And you can imagine the joy on a server's face when they find this generous tip, that they would pull it out, and as they unfolded it, realize that actually, in fact, it wasn't money at all. And on the inside, it had a message that said, "Don't be fooled. Money can't buy you happiness. What you need is Jesus." And then it continued to share a, quotes, message of salvation in it. I can tell you right now that people who have not found the peace and the joy that Jesus brings are going to not be interested in whatever Jesus, that person, has to peddle to them. The gospel is a gospel of generosity, not one of cheap tricks to try to get people to believe that Jesus is what you need. The second one that I saw came from, it was an outcome of the fact that we just had Halloween Day. And There are many Christians out there who believe that we need to have nothing in the world to do with Halloween whatsoever because of its satanic and pagan origins. And this particular Christian thought that they needed to make sure that the world knew where they stood. And so next to their door, as people would approach for trick-or-treating, there were pieces of paper that had been outlined into the shape of a cross, and on each piece of paper there was a message. The message all put together said something along the lines of, "We do not believe in satanic holidays in this house. There will be no candy if you knock on our door, but everybody needs Jesus, and if you want us to tell you about Jesus, feel free to knock." And I thought to myself, who in their right mind knocks at a door that doesn't have candy on Halloween? That's nuts. But even worse, is that the kind of Jesus that I would ever want presented to me? I wouldn't, and I suspect that most people would feel the same way. Now for the one that I saw this week that brought me great joy and actually surprise. I have a friend who's a pastor in the Washington Conference. He's a fairly conservative and traditional individual, and every once in a while, for the most part, I agree with the things that he posts on Facebook, but every once in a while, I see things and I'm just like, oh, I don't know if I would go that far in your ideas or thoughts. But on this particular day, he had a post about Halloween, and I had a feeling that I wasn't going to like whatever he had to say. But I was surprised, because he initiated the post describing his personal feelings about Halloween, but then the second part of his post described the fact that he understood the message of Matthew 5, that his life lived has influence with the people around him. And then he had a list. He said, here are the five or six things that I will not do this Halloween. I'm not going to dress up. I'm also not going to turn off my lights and lock my doors. I'm also not going to ignore the knocks that come to my door. I'm also not going to serve kids health food or fruit. And I'm not going to, and there was one or two others that he wasn't going to do that some people might think are helpful somehow to the message of Christ. What he said he was going to do, oh yeah, I think one of the other things that he wasn't going to do was, I'm not going to preach to the people who come to my door. What he said he was going to do was that he was going to open his door when somebody knocked. I'm going to smile at the person who's standing there at my door. I am going to give them a quality treat. And I'm going to tell them, God bless you. And I thought to myself, what a difference the influence of this particular pastor will have over the people who come to his door compared to the people who come to the door that has the cross with really nasty sentiments written all over it. I know that as Christians, we have values, we have beliefs. We understand that we are called to live our lives in certain ways that the Bible describes. But in so doing, if we do not do it with love and with care, genuine care for those around us, no matter what walk of life they're in or where they're at in that walk, our potential for positive influence can quickly go down the drain. Ellen White says these words in the Mount of Blessings, "Christ tears away the wall of partition, the self-love, the dividing prejudice of nationality, and teaches a love for all the human family. He lifts men from the narrow circle that their selfishness prescribes. He abolishes all territorial lines and artificial distinctions of society. He makes no difference between neighbors and strangers, friends and enemies. He teaches us to look upon every needy soul as our neighbor and the world as our field." And so as we leave this place today and live out the Christianity that God has called us to in the week to come, it is my prayer that each of us will have the courage and the joy and the love to treat others as Christ would, in ways that will make them want to flock to us, because even if we don't agree, we're somebody worth being around. As we close today, I want to invite you to sing that children's song that has good lessons for each one of us. Let it shine, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let's sing together.